robatto, mister robatto. Dopomani gatto, mister robatto, manda con i vade. Dopomani gatto, mister robatto, di insurgibilità. All right, and we are back with another episode of the Puma Venture Capital podcast. And this week we are starting a topic that we'll probably talk about for the next couple of weeks, which is the Telesurgery Consensus Conference in Orlando, Florida, that we attended over this past weekend. And that was an event that we saw a lot of our surgeon venture partners attend. And it was an event that was largely driven by the vision of our co-founder, Dr. Vip Patel, who put this event together. And it was quite an event to attend, one that I have not seen very often in my career in terms of a consensus event that thinks about technology that is coming and tries to build a consensus around how to deal with that technology. Just that in and of itself was quite fascinating, but the agenda was very diverse. There were attendees from all over the globe, surgeons, healthcare administrators and payers and device companies, industry, telecom, FDA, FCC, the World Bank, the White House was there, ministers of health. We had 10 sitting presidents from surgical societies and 40 heads of academic departments. It was quite incredible to see those individuals all in place to talk about the technology that's not even really out yet. And telesurgery is very early. It's very uncharted in terms of territory and what's been tried so far. But we think it's a really interesting time to try to understand that, as does the Society of Robotic Surgery that put the conference on, and understand the challenges and opportunities and see if from a Puma venture capital perspective, maybe there's something to do from the investable landscape. So what we thought we would do on this first call is bring on one of our surgeon venture partners. It's Amir Hassan, who has not been on before. So it's also a chance for us to meet Amir and talk to him about what he's been doing. He is a surgeon venture partner for Puma Venture Capital. He's the immediate past president of the Society of Vascular and Interventional Neurology. He's currently at Valley Baptist Medical Center in Arlington, Texas, and he's the head of the neuroscience department there. And I could go on and on and on with the accolades for Amir. He's also just a great guy and someone I love having a conversation with. So first and foremost, Amir, thanks for joining us for this conversation.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. So why don't we start, Amir, with just high level takeaways? I mean, you were at the conference, and I suspect that for you, this was, you know, by far the most amount of information you've gotten about telesurgery in probably ever. So give us your just high level takeaways of the weekend.
So what's interesting about all of this is, you know, even when I was originally brought on, I'm a skeptic. And it was nice to actually see everything that's going on in this space from the standpoint of robotics in the medical field, mostly in surgery, right? The majority of the attendance was urologists. So it was kind of cool seeing everybody else's perspective and then integrating all that and then discussing, you know, the benefits of all of this. Like, yes, we know robotic surgery is more precise. It's consistent, minimally invasive, kind of like endovascular is. Now, if we can move to telesurgery and what we're able to do and overcome the ethical, the billing, the insurance companies, all of those hurdles, it's going to be amazing, right? Teaming that up with artificial intelligence, real-time data, right? Fixing some of we had some great conversations about latency and all of that kind of stuff, but just to me, the biggest thing was healthcare accessibility, right? You know that SVIN's mission, Mission Thrombectomy Program, just became part of the United Nations Economic Social Council. It was a huge milestone for us, but improving access to care is really why I got involved in this in the beginning. And now, actually, after going to this conference, I think it's a much more realistic timeline compared to before this conference. I probably said this is something my daughter, who's 12 years old, by the way, is probably going to interact with versus now. Yes, no, I think I'll be able to do this, you know, before I retire.
Yeah. Well, for me, I think that it was interesting to see that you know, if you break it down, think about the technological challenges to do telesurgery. The conference suggested in various forms that the technology is basically there. You know, that we are seeing the latency issue able to be overcome, you know, so, you know, just kind of progress since 2001 when the first telesurgery case was attempted to where we are today, you know, whether we're talking about 5G, 6G, or fiber optic, that, you know, there is a pathway within 1 to 2,000 kilometers to be able to do a surgery and have latency not be an issue. And that otherwise the technology is capable of, you know, doing the procedure with, you know, relative level of success. And we don't, maybe we don't know exactly what the downside safety issues might be. And there's a whole host of other issues, but let's stay on technology for a second, Amir. And I want to just hear your thoughts on, you know, both what you saw presented and specifically some of the China experience that was presented, because now we've got actual live cases that have been performed, you know, yes, under, you know, circumstances that are really perfect, were set up to be perfect and maybe not real world, but nonetheless, proving that the technology can work. What do you think on the technology that you saw this weekend and the proof of concept, if you will?
So it is nice to see, again, the advancement in the decades that robotics have been going on to get to this point. Seeing those cases done in China was very impressive from my standpoint, right? We don't have anything similar to that in the neuro space yet. So seeing that real-time data transmission, the remote access for an expertise, a surgical expertise in an underserved area, is going to really enhance healthcare accessibility. So to me, that was really the big deal. I was very excited. I loved seeing the cases, the different types of cases, the technology, the different, you know, rural / metropolitan area connections being made, and then the conversations that went on further about, again, improvements in latency, potential improvement from the standpoint of satellite access, right? Hearing some of the stuff about, you know, at the dinner, talking to somebody who's been working with NASA and how he's, you know, what their expected latency is, how they see it improving. It really all came together very nicely. And something that was probably a dream just, you know, a decade ago, from a real world example standpoint, right? Because of the old latency problems and challenges, seeing how that has improved significantly, definitely, you see the light now versus it's not, you know, it's not the light at the end of the tunnel anymore.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I feel like I came away thinking, especially with regard to latency, which is such a big issue as we're talking about remote, like, okay, this is actually solved. You know, we have the technology to solve the latency issue, you know, within, you know, the confines of a certain distance. Obviously, you're still limited by speed of light, but I think that, you know, it seems like it's relatively speaking solved. But then you get to these other issues, you know, and here we can take kind of more maybe US-centric view, because a lot of these issues directly apply to the US and how our healthcare system works. And you start to think about insurance, you know, just different various risks, regulatory risks and compliance and, you know, licensing of surgeons. And there's just a whole host of requirements and challenges. And so I want to see if you can riff on that a little bit and just tell me what you think about all of those challenges and what kind of rises to the most significant for you and how limiting those challenges are going to be in terms of actual adoption in the US market.
So I enjoyed that conversation and the debate on the panel, right? The president's panel day two, it was great questions by the audience and just excellent dialogue from the different specialties, seeing the different challenges we all have had and will probably incur during this voyage. From the neuro standpoint, I would say we have the same challenges when it comes to the licensing, and whatnot. But what I was impressed with, I think it was our colleague from Spain mentioned, you know, he might be the best person in the world that does this procedure, but he will never be allowed to do this procedure in the United States because of not doing residency here, not being board certified and whatnot. So then to me, it's more of a proctoring thing. And this is where I see the future, especially in the neuroendovascular space. I see it more as a proctoring somebody when it comes to these complex surgeries, bringing in that top tier surgical expertise to that underserved area and improving healthcare accessibility. That's where I see the majority of this going in your elective type of procedures. I think, though, that we can work together, work with Congress, bring patient survivors. They need to understand how important it is to improve access for emergent types of procedures to these remote areas. And that's where I think stroke is going to be a different animal compared to an elective aneurysm treatment, right? Or, you know, a prostate treatment, a kidney procedure. All of these procedures are going to be very, very different because they could be scheduled. We can make sure that if there's a local surgeon, then it's more of a proctorship going on. And that way your local surgeon is really the responsible one. He's the face. He's the one you're going to follow up with clinic. And I think that is the right thing to do. Whereas stroke, if there is no stroke specialist in that area, you need whatever it is, a nurse practitioner, a physician assistant, maybe partnering with a local radiologist who's also doing peripheral types of procedures. And he would be able to get that access for you. And then you have to do the procedure. But then there has to be a government mandate working with the NIH, CMS, FDA, and everybody and saying, hey, you know, we're going to have allow one license for stroke interventions, for example, if we're planning on doing this robotically, from a telesurgical standpoint. You can't only have a doctor in Montana being licensed to treat the patient in Montana. You're going to have one license for the United States. And it's something that I think is very doable. I think it happened during COVID, where most states waived the rules when it came to licensing. But they need some sort of guidance. I think it's the FDA working with CMS, working with everybody, you know, in the healthcare space from a governmental standpoint, and getting Congress support, congressional support to get this approved even prior to doing telesurgery. Like it boggles my mind that I'm licensed in one state and I can't be licensed in another. And all they do is ask you for the same things, right? Where'd you go to med school? Where'd you do residency? And then they give you the license anyways. So I do think a lot of these challenges are going to be answered hopefully before telesurgery really takes off, but we need to start laying down that foundation.
Yeah, so you went there, and I definitely want to spend a little time on stroke because it does seem from the conference and from a lot of the work that we have done prior to the conference that if there's going to be a killer app, so to speak, that comes out of telesurgery, from which, you know, the rest of the procedures are going to be able to stand up, it's going to be stroke. I think telesurgery is highly likely to either succeed or fail on the shoulders of how things go with stroke. So I want to get to that, and I want to ask you to back up, and we'll talk about why it is that stroke is so amenable to the telesurgery route. I also want to mention that, you know, what you said before you talked about stroke in terms of the, you know, the model of telesurgery that we're talking about was another theme during the show that was really important. I think Intuitive Surgical hit on this and made it very clear, as did others in industry, which is, you know, there are various models of telesurgery. It's not just, you know, you're taking over a surgery and your patient is 500 miles away. There's the mentoring telesurgery that you described. And I think Intuitive Surgical talked about the fact that they're already pursuing this. And we know there are other private companies that are doing something similar. You know, there's all kinds of secondary telesurgery scenarios where you could be a remote doc and you're just there to help as needed. You know, you're a doc on, you know, sitting over the shoulder of the surgeons at the site that's actually performing the surgery. And then, of course, you can then evolve into primary telesurgery where you're taking over a case and you're in remote. So there could be step functions here to get to the ultimate goal of primary telesurgery. And I think that was an important takeaway of the progression that we'll probably see. But let's come back to stroke. Why does it make sense in stroke? What is it about, you know, the stroke landscape here, if you were to describe it to folks that don't understand the landscape as well, for why it makes more sense in stroke than it does in other types of indications?
So the big deal with stroke is its impact. It's the number two worldwide killer. It's the number five kill in the United States. It used to be the number three kill in the United States. And once we had access to new treatments like mechanical thrombectomy, taking these, you know, stent retrievers and aspiration catheters into the brain and sucking out the clot, it went from number three to number five killer. So we could bring it down significantly if we were able to improve access to care. On top of that, just think about this. Every minute delay in stroke is 2 million neurons die. It's the number one cause of worldwide disability, number one cause of disability in the United States. And we know stroke in rural areas has consistently been underserved. So how do you improve, excuse me, how do you improve stroke access when you know that after years of our mission thrombectomy program, it used to be called MT2020, the goal was to double mechanical thrombectomy access from 2016 to 2020. And we did that. But after we did that, we published this MT Glass paper in Circulation a few months ago, and it showed there's only a 2.6% worldwide utilization of mechanical thrombectomy. That's horrible. 20% of stroke is large vessel occlusion, but only 2.6% of them are getting treated. So by having that access, by doing telesurgery powered by robotics, enabling a neurointerventionalist to perform these complex procedures remotely, getting access to those advanced imaging, using potentially like the AI, like the elbow detection, right? Like in our hospital, we use Viz AI. Having that real-time data transmission, all of this would improve access in those remote and underserved areas. And that's what our goal is, right? Our society goal is really to enhance healthcare accessibility, specifically to improve mechanical thrombectomy access worldwide, because that will minimize the need for patient transfers, reduce associated risks and costs, and in the end of the day, improve patient outcomes.
Yeah. Yeah. So Amir, you know, you talked about some of the challenges on a kind of state-by-state basis and needing, you know, a single license for the whole United States. But even here, you know, couldn't we think about this as a step function as well? So you take any state, you know, even New York, I mean, you take any, you know, state that's going to have one largely populated city with, you know, a good hospital system and a stroke center of excellence. And that could act as kind of a hub and spoke model for within the state, other, you know, hospital systems that you could bring a patient to in a kind of telesurgery, remote surgery type of scenario. Could that work? And in that case, if that's kind of the first step, does it make it more realistic? And what would be the hurdles for that first step to become a reality?
Which first step exactly?
It's staying in state. So, you know, kind of reducing, and I can give you even, you know, kind of a more, kind of a cleaner one, if you will, staying in state and even staying within the same hospital system. So, you know, a hospital system that has, you know, 8 or 9 hospitals in the state. And so you have, you know, one where the top surgeon sits that does the thrombectomy procedure, but now you can potentially serve, you know, patients across all those 8 or 9 hospitals.
You're saying what the challenge is to that today?
Yeah. Would there be, so if you had the robotic,
I think that's the immediate benefit. Like if someone created a good stroke robot today, I would see the implementation today in those hub and spoke models. Like our comprehensive stroke center in Harlingen, Texas, we have a standalone ED in Weslaco. We have a primary stroke center in Brownsville. So these are 20-30 minute drives from me. Neither of them has neurointerventional. So those patients are always transferred. So yes, of course, if we were able to get this and built this system, that's like the low-hanging fruit. Tackling these access issues and decreasing transfer times in hub and spoke models, getting whatever we need, you know, in the neuroendovascular space, I think the hurdles are going to be appropriate triage and getting access. Once you have that groin access or radial access, then yes, connecting everything to the robot and then working with your team and building, you know, a pool of neurointerventionists that would all stay at mothership, all complex cases, aneurysms, AVMs, everything would still be transferred to mothership. But stroke could be then, you would save minimum 60 to 90 minutes by treating the patient at that site, at the spoke.
Yeah. And so you could imagine if you had a rural hospital, let's say in this, even in your system, imagine you have a rural hospital that doesn't have the capabilities to do stroke as you described. You know, is it, are there qualified personnel there that could be trained to kind of get you set up, you know, where you can start to drive the catheter and do the procedure? Like, is that a reality, or does there need to be additional training of, you know, RNs or what have you to be able to do that?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, in the neuro space, I think it's going to be most likely using NPs or PAs, because in my hospital, they can get access, right? They can get a femoral, they can put in a femoral sheath, they can put in a central line, radial line. So I think the most realistic plan would be training staff on the robot system, training staff, appropriate staff members like PAs or NPs to get that groin access. And then you would then take your devices up remotely. But we need to see, you know, it's not just about a robot. You then would need to see the room, right? And this is where tools like Proximy, I need to see how my tech, like how nervous is he right now? I need to see, you know, one picture of the room, one picture at the groin, and taking all that information in while also looking at AP and lateral in order to do the procedure.
Okay. So, you know, one of the other topics that came up that we can kind of relate to stroke and see what you think about is, you know, the hospitals talked realistically about not just the hospitals. I heard a lot of physicians and surgeons that were there in the hallways talk to a lot of them about, well, you know, how are we going to get paid for this? You know, who's going to get paid? You know, now you've got a number of medical professionals who are at one site and then other professionals at the other site. Reimbursement codes are already established. Is there going to be more pay for this? You know, who is going to pay for this? What does this look like from a cost and from a revenue perspective for the hospitals and the physicians? And that was a major issue. In fact, some of the hospitals said that they're not as worried about other risks and regulatory risk as they are about this revenue and cost risk. But as it relates to stroke, you mentioned it, but we know that, you know, you get a patient to a hospital within 2 hours and the results are significantly different than they are if you go beyond 2 hours and you have a disability for potentially for the rest of your life and what the costs are of those disabilities. So, you know, I would assume that it just feels to me like the stakeholders are all kind of aligned as it relates to stroke, which I think why many of us are excited about this, but still you have that challenge. So in that same scenario that we described, we're now talking about the same hospital system. We're talking about the same state. Do you see this still as a reality if there were no changes to reimbursement codes? Or do we also need support from insurance for this to get off the ground?
So from my standpoint and neuroendovascular and stroke, I don't think it's going to be an issue if we used nurse practitioners or physician assistants. So to me, that's the key, because I'm still going to be doing the whole procedure. Nobody's cutting a hole. Nobody's making any holes for me. It's minimally invasive. Just putting a sheath in the radial artery or the femoral artery. From the stroke standpoint, I don't think it's going to be as challenging to get approved and worry about the billing and the coding like it will be for the surgeries. I think that's going to get a little bit more complex. What does the local surgeon get versus what is the surgeon at, you know, the mentor, the proctor getting? How are they going to share that? That's going to have to come to some sort of agreement with some sort of society guideline, committee guideline statements. But if this is going to work in the stroke world, I don't think that's going to be as challenging, because you're not going to be proctoring another neurointerventionalist. You're going to be basically someone just getting you access and then you taking over doing the whole procedure. So you would get the physician fee and the hospital would be getting the DRG for the procedure and the admission. So they have no problem hiring, you know, or basically keeping one of their NPs that already covers ICUs on call to be able to be with you and get that access and be there in the room while everything's going on. So I think from the stroke world, it is actually pretty feasible.
Okay. So last question for you, Amir. I know we got to let you go. You're always a busy man, and it's kind of circling back to, how Puma thinks about this. You know, so from our perspective, we obviously think about this from, you know, whether there are, you know, investable vehicles for us. And certainly one of the options is, you know, thinking about one of these early stage robotic companies that are focused on stroke and trying to come out with robots for stroke. And they're all fairly early stage, starting first in human roughly this year, if maybe a little, maybe one or two of them a little bit more advanced, but still a few years from market probably. You know, you're very close to this market too. You and I have had conversations here. Are you confident that we could see some of these robots come out and that they could be impactful in the field? And would you need a robot like this if it weren't capable of telesurgery, or is telesurgery kind of a key function that you're going to look for to adopt one of these systems?
So great question. So I've always been on, again, I'm always on the con side of this debate over the last few years at our neuroendovascular meetings. And several of my friends and colleagues, you know, always argue with me because they always say, Amir, you were at the forefront of AI and mechanical thrombectomy technology, part of all the breakthroughs trials. How do you not see this as the next step? And my thing is always about efficiency, right? We have a very busy lab. We do 1,300 neuro cases a year, and we have 3 biplanes. We load them up, right? And we're going from one room to the other room to the other room. So if the robot does not speed up my case, I don't see me or any of my partners using a robot in our practice. So for me, telesurgery is the reason why we would get the robotic system, because, again, like I said earlier, we have 2 spokes that are owned by our institution. Then we have another 4 or 5 that are owned by other hospitals that transfer into us. So potentially partnering with them and improving access to care and decreasing the transfer time, improving outcomes, that's where we see the value. And that's why we would get on the boat. But from a neuroendovascular standpoint, you know, this is why Corendus failed. Corendus tried to convince cardiology and then tried to convince neurology that, oh, well, this is better, but you never had a study showing it was better. And unless you have a several thousand patient study showing decreased, morbidity, mortality from these procedures, I don't see anybody shifting, because we're already minimally invasive. So neuroendovascular is already next day, patient goes home. Why would, you're not going to shorten the length of stay like, you know, years ago, Da Vinci robot showed that, hey, we're decreasing length of stay with robotic surgery. Okay, well, neuroendovascular is already minimally invasive, so you can't make it any shorter. Your patient's already leaving the ICU next day and going home. So if it's not length of stay, and it's definitely not faster, most interventions don't care about radiation. You know, it's about speed, you know, trying to be efficient, get as many cases done as possible. But telesurgery, you know, that is really where it's at. And being able to improve my you know, tentacles, my outreach, and covering my hub and spoke by treating patients at the spoke and decreasing that transfer time, that's where I see the real benefit of all this.
And does the hub have the capacity to handle that extra volume that would come its way?
Yeah, I mean, the way we do it today is the person who's on stroke anyways is just waiting for strokes. So I don't, and there's always a backup. So there's always a backup neurointerventionalist. There's the primary on call and a backup. Very rarely, like I can't even think of a time in the 12 years I've practiced that the backup actually had to be called in. So now assuming, right, there's delays in transfer and this and that, hypothetically, you're more likely to have it happen if you're covering, you know, 8 or 9 spokes. So we would just make sure we have a robust call schedule, and you'd have one on call, one backup. That's still more efficient than every single one of these hospitals hiring somebody to be on call.
Amir Hassan, we're going to have to leave that here from Amit Hassan. Love that our names are so similar. Thank you so much for the time and for your thoughts on the telesurgery space. That was very helpful. And we will for sure have you on again talking about other topics, but wish you a good afternoon over there. I know you're at a new conference today and continuing your hard work. And to all of you listening, thank you so much for listening in. And please do send us any comments or questions you have, either to me or to Amir, and I'll make sure that we get them answered. Thanks, everyone. Have a good afternoon and a good evening. Take care.